This is the Thanks for Sharing podcast, the podcast where we explore all things recovery, healing, and relationship.
Remember to subscribe and download episodes in the iTunes Store, the Google Play Store, or on the Podbean app.
You can find more Thanks for Sharing at www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com or on Facebook at facebook.com/healingpaths. That's paths with an S.
Welcome to the Thanks for Sharing podcast. I'm Jackie P.
I'm John T.
So today for our episode, we are going to do a story episode in which we share some stories that are meaningful to us, stories that we might use in therapy with clients to illustrate a point.
So it's story time with Jackie and John.
There
so
you
might want to pause this, get a juice box, get your pillow and blanket, get comfortable. So we were talking a little bit before we hit record, kind of what stories we wanted to tell. And I don't know that there's really a theme, which I don't know that there has to be.
Right.
But I was going to start with this is a personal experience of mine when I was 18 years old. And I was working at a camp between Yellowstone National Park and Teton National Park. And part of my job that year was to be a guide in the backcountry. So
you were, how old did you say?
I was 18.
18, okay.
18. So I would take groups of boys on these week-long 50-mile backpacking trips. There'd be, you know, 6 to 8, 14 to 16-year-olds. So really, like, almost my peers.
Uh-huh.
And then their adult leaders would be there, too. And I was the one who knew what
you
was
were
going
in charge.
On. Oh, yeah. So it was a big power trip and all that. But it was really, like, this was one of the favorite jobs I've ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, so the big Powerball winner yesterday, $750
mm-hmm.
million. I was listening to that on the radio and I started thinking, what would I do? And my first thought was, like, after I, you know, set up a trust or whatever for myself so I never have to work again, I would go and live in the mountains and I would hike. But anyway, to get ready for these 50-mile hikes or taking these groups of boys, and I would go, when this was your job, you'd go three or four times throughout the summer with three or four different groups. But the first 2 weeks of the camp were just the staff there that was getting ready for the campers to come.
Okay.
And it was like towards the end of July, and in that part of the country, like the end of July is still like, I guess it's kind of spring. It's
right.
Definitely not summer.
No, because you're just getting snowmelt.
Yeah,
finally,
like,
by that point.
We would have to dig away like 6 feet of snow on our staff tent sites the first day, and then spend 2 or 3 days letting the ground dry out, and then we would set up our tents in the snow. So we would do our training hike. So all the people who were going to guide that summer, they had to learn the trail. And we didn't have the luxury of 5 days like we would take with the campers.
Mm-hmm.
We had one night.
Oh.
So we would cover that 50-mile distance overnight.
Okay.
So it was really, really hard, pretty intense. But at 18, I could do it, and I could do it with 40 or 50 pounds of gear on my back, and I loved it. So the first hike we took was through Beckler Meadows. Beckler is the part of Yellowstone where there's no roads. So the stuff you see in Beckler, you're not going to see if you do a car tour of Yellowstone. You have to be on foot. So we did that, and Beckler Meadows, the river was really swollen. Like, most of the time we were walking through chest-deep water with our packs above our heads, and it's weird to use the word fun, but it was fun. I was there with my friends, and so we did that, and we got back to camp that night, and the camp director called me into his office, and this was my fourth summer working at that camp, and he said, we have two groups that are going to do the Teton Crest Trail this summer, and if you want to take one of those groups, I want to give you preference for doing that. So I said, yeah, I want to take one of those groups. And he said, the problem is we have to do the training hike tomorrow. And I know you just got back from doing 50 miles in Beckler Meadows and you're probably tired. So I want you to know, like, this isn't mandatory that you do this. I want to give you the choice.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, yeah, I'm in. And he said, and the other thing you need to know is there's going to be a blizzard on Teton Pass tomorrow night.
Oh, nice.
And that's where you're going to be sleeping. And so, of course, I was like, yeah, I'm in.
You're 18, so
right?
Of course you're in.
And I went with a group of guys who had guided on that trail for, you know, three or four summers before that, and they were all going just to go together and just to have fun. So it was me and these older men, like early 20s older men. that were going. So we got to Teton Village that morning, and we took the tram up to the top of Fox Creek Pass. So we take the tram up, and then we were going to hike to the base of the Tetons. We were going to camp at the base of the Tetons, and then we were going to hike around the Tetons and go down the next morning at Jenny Lake. So within about a mile of Fox Creek Pass where the tram went, we were on top of 6 to 8 feet of hard-crusted snow. Mm. We couldn't even see the trail. And the guy that was leading us, he'd been on that trail enough. He's like, I know about where the trail goes under the snow, and I'm going to take you that way so that you're kind of familiar with how this feels. So I don't know if you've ever hiked on snow with 50 pounds of gear on your back. We didn't have snowshoes. We didn't have, like, it was just my regular hiking boots. Okay. So you kind of take one step forward and slide half a step back every time.
Uh-huh.
It was really exhausting. And we started at like 5 a.m. because we knew it was going to be a really long day. And you'd walk along, and most of the time the snow was pretty hard crusted, but there were spots where it was soft, and you would sink in, and it wasn't just up to like your ankle or your knee, like you'd post hole up to your hip.
Oh, wow.
And you'd have to climb out, and then you'd keep going and hope that you didn't fall again sometime soon. So it was about lunchtime, and we were at the top of, I forget what it was called, but we're at the top of this place that when I went and hiked there later in the summer with a group, these boulders were, you know, 12, 20 feet tall, and they were like bare rock. Level with the ground, level with the snow when we walked past. So we all sat on this big rock, like, we're just going to take a short water break. An hour and a half later, we all woke up and we're like, oh, we need to get going if we're going to make Hurricane or Alaska Basin is where we camped, if we're going to make Alaska Basin by nightfall. So we kept going, and I remember thinking as I was walking and as I was post-holing up to my leg, like, this has got to be some metaphor for life. Like, in 18, I don't think I'd experienced life quite like that.
Uh-huh.
But I think I had enough of a sense to say, this is teaching me something. And so I started to kind of formulate this story in my mind. Like, I was there with people that I trusted, and they were helping me get through this. And there were times, try as we might, as we walked along, there were just things that we couldn't foresee, like falling through the snow up to your hip. There were just things that we couldn't foresee that were going to happen that made this more difficult. And the problem wasn't like not being able to see that or not being able to prevent that. It was just going to happen, and we had to keep going. Mm-hmm. So we get into Alaska Basin, and it's starting to be dusk, and the blizzard is starting to come in, and we brought two tents with us. So there were five of us together. We brought a three-man tent and a two-man tent. And none of us brought winter gear because this was a summer camp. And so we thought we would be fine. And so we talked, and we decided it would be best to put all of our gear in the two-man tent, and the five of us were going to sleep in the three-man tent.
To, like, help with body temperature and stuff?
Yeah, and it worked really great. We slept head to toe, and two people slept on top of the pile. And we were also exhausted. We slept really well. At one point in the night, we had to open both doors of the tent to get airflow because it was so hot in there. So we woke up in the morning, and we were laughing, and, you know, snow, fresh snow was everywhere, and it was really exciting. And so we go out the next day, and so that first day had kind of been level hiking because we were about level elevation wise with the base of the Tetons in Alaska Basin. The next day we had to hike up something called Hurricane Pass, right at the bottom of, I think, the middle Teton. So we had to hike up that, and that was in the snow. And then from there down to Jenny Lake, it was like a mountainside. And again, going there later in the summer, there were lots of switchbacks. It was a very long trail. What we decided to do, because we were tired and because we were young and impulsive and stupid, we decided we were just going to ski down the hill on our feet. So we found a corridor where it didn't look like there were a lot of trees. Later in the summer, there were a ton of trees, but there was so much snow, we would get like 2 or 3 feet of the top of these 20 or 30 foot pine trees. So we start skiing down, and we decided, well, I guess we were smart enough. We're like, we'll taper this. Like, we'll give some space, and when you get to a point where you're slowing down, stop, and we'll all kind of collect there, make sure everything's okay, and then we'll keep going. So we skied down, and it was exhilarating, and my friend JD, who was notorious for being a klutz, he tumbled down most of the way, and it was only catching the tops of the pine trees that stopped him. And we got down that mountain when we would hike this with our groups. That would be one day. Mm-hmm. We got down in probably 2 hours because of how fast it got. And as I think back on that story now, like those were really extreme circumstances.
Right.
I couldn't do that anymore the way that I did it. I don't think my body would handle it. And I think that my mind and my responsible adult part of me wouldn't allow me to do that again. But I think when we're faced with extreme circumstances, we have to do pretty extreme things to survive.
Right.
Like skiing down the side of a mountain, or, you know, sleeping 5 people in a 3-man tent to conserve body heat.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting, you know, being a decade removed from that, or more than a decade removed from that, just how I view those circumstances now. At the time, it didn't feel like a choice, not because someone was making me that I went, but because like this is an adventure and you don't pass up adventures. Mm. And now looking at that and...
Well, in that age too, you think you're invincible.
Right.
So it's all in on adventure because you're mm-hmm. not worried about injuring or dying or...
Yeah, which I, you know, I think there was probably just enough unawareness of the risks that mm-hmm. made it so we could get through that. And I look back at my life at other things that were really risky and really intense, and some things that I chose and some things that were put on my plate. And I also, one of the things I take from that story too is I think sometimes one of the ways that we survive is not knowing what is really at stake
mm-hmm.
and really what's mm-hmm. going on.
Yeah.
We can just go.
Yeah, I like that. Okay, so one of the stories I was thinking about, I just in the past couple of weeks, I've been working a lot with relationship issues that mm-hmm. sometimes it seems to me like there's a theme that like clients come in with and you're
I think
like
they
oh,
have a coordinating meeting.
Right? Not everybody's on the same schedule, but you're kind of like, hey, everybody seems to be moving in this direction or the conversation seem to be going here. So I was talking to a couple of clients this past week actually and shared a story about I think I was like maybe 19. And I had, right after high school, I moved away to college. I mean, it was a junior college, and so it wasn't, but it was, you know, I probably 4 or 5 hour drive from my house, and so it's not like I came home all the time or anything like that, and it was really fun. It was in southern Utah, and I had come home for the summer, and the church that I had gone to growing up had asked me if I'd work with some of the youth. For the summer. And it was this group of 11 and 12-year-old girls that I was going to work with. There was probably about 9 of them. And I said, sure, that'd be great. And we had a ton of fun. And, you know, kind of when you're home from college for the summer, I mean, you're trying, at least I was trying to earn enough money so that I could go back to school and have money to live off of. But I also didn't, like, my friends were in different places. And, you know, so I didn't have, like, that group that I would hang out with in high school. And so I would just plan things for these girls like, hey, during the week, do you want to come over and we'll watch this movie? Or I'd take them to the movies and, you know, they thought it was great and I was having fun. Anyway, summer ends, I go back to college and the next time I was home, I saw one of them, you know, and I said hello and she was like, hi. And there was just kind of this, just a brief moment of kind of this awkward silence. And in that moment, I had this realization, like, that all of a sudden I was like, oh, I'm the adult.
This is on me.
Like, I have to, up until that point, I had been used to, you know, the people at church, the older leaders and different things like that. When they saw me, they'd always be like, hey, how are you? What's going on in your life? I didn't ask them that question. Like, I was 16, 17, whatever. I didn't care what was going on in their life, right? Like, and I think sometimes those relationships are kind of one way in which I don't think to say to that person, like, how's work going? Because I don't really understand what they do for work. But it was this situation in which I had been kind of this adult leader for her. And now we were seeing each other. And you know, like I said, it was just brief. I don't think the awkward silence was too long before it clicked in. And I was kind of like, oh, I'm that adult now.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to be like, how are you? How is school? What's going on? What's new in your life? You know, we had this great conversation, but very one-sided. You know, I mean, she was 12. Like, she's not going to ask me about college. She doesn't really comprehend college.
Who are you dating?
Right? So, you know, she went away, and it was one of those, I was like, okay, this is what it's like to be an adult.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, it was, you know, like, in that experience, I didn't learn and conquer being an adult, but it was one of those eye-opening moments into where I was like, I'm in a different position of life,
mm-hmm.
and it feels different. There's different responsibility. I shared with one of my clients, I don't know, and maybe I was aware of it, and 'cause I remember thinking, like, am I doing this right? Am I getting this right? But I don't think that my mom really ever got that piece. You know, and my kids would even joke sometimes before my mom passed away. My kids would joke about how, you know, they'd be in junior high or they'd be in high school, and my mom would pick them up for their birthday dinner. My mom, most of her life, she was an elementary school teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, the last 6 years, she was a school counselor. And they would joke how, you know, you pick grandma picks you up to go on your birthday dinner, and you're like, oh, what are we going to talk about? And then all you have to say is, hey, grandma, how's school? And, like, grandma talks the whole rest of the time. And they'd be like, and it's really kind of weird because grandma doesn't realize she should ask us about school.
Yeah.
Like, we're actually the students.
Yeah.
But she didn't, you know? So I think there was part of that for me. I was like, am I getting this right? I want to get this right. I know this is an important piece. But having that realization that, like, welcome to adulthood,
mm-hmm.
the rules are different.
Well, it's like we talked about, was it last week we recorded our adult child in the workplace?
2 weeks ago,
I think. 2 weeks ago. Oh, yeah, last week was step 12. It's one of those moments that's like, I'm not the child anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, I don't know, I would go out on a limb and say, even if you don't grow up under adult child circumstances, you do have those moments where you have to recognize,
yeah, probably,
I'm in a different place.
Yeah.
And we see that a lot in the, I think, the recovery community, is that there are people who are further along the path
mm-hmm.
than others. And some of them get that, and some of them realize it's important for me to turn around and build bridges,
mm-hmm.
and it's important for me to pass on what's
yeah.
been given to me. And there's some who, you know, Carver Brown would probably categorize as the crusty weird people in meetings.
In the groups, yeah.
That don't, like, they just keep their head down and they
uh-huh.
keep focused on themselves, and
yeah.
they don't know when it's time to turn around and give.
Yeah. I have one of my kids is almost 18. My third daughter is almost 18. And, you know, sometimes she is relational, and sometimes it's still all about her,
yeah.
right? And I have to remind myself that at 17, that's kind of how it goes. But the other day, you know, school was starting for her and my younger daughter. I mean, the older ones were at college, but the school was getting ready to start. And, you know, I blessed my daughters with thick eyebrows. Now, when I was growing up, nobody told me, like, hey, you got to tame those things. Like, so some of my pictures, I'm pretty close to a unibrow. And as I've gotten older, it's not as bad, but my kids have it. And so
I didn't realize that we shared the same eyebrow makeup.
Yes. So I have to, fortunately right now, like, the bushier eyebrows are in. So I'm like, yay, we're in right now. We still have to tame them.
That's why I'm so hot right now.
But my 14-year-old hasn't really, like, she didn't care, like, and it kind of hurts. And so she was just like, but she had started to say this summer, like, hey, when you guys go get your eyebrows done, I need to go. And so my 17-year-old was going to get it, like, the Monday before school started, and was like, oh, hey, you said you needed to go. Do you want to go with me? And I was like, yes. Like, for this moment, she was aware that somebody had something to do, while it was the same thing, but it was like she wasn't just in her own
mm-hmm.
world looking at her life and
mm-hmm.
this is what I need to do, and could look up and be like, oh, hey, you needed to do that too. Do you want to go with me? I could drive you. You know, I mean, next week it'll probably be back to it's all about me.
Yeah.
But for the moment, I'm like, okay, there's a relational skill that's starting to formulate that she's able to look up and say, I've heard you say this,
yeah.
and I can help you there.
Yeah, and I would imagine the reason why that relational skill is there now is because she's seen you do that.
Right.
And that's something that you do. That, so my kids started school this week too, and So my oldest is in second grade, and I can just see, like, parts of him being a really little boy are, they're going away.
Yeah.
And it's sad, like, he doesn't want his best friends to be the girl across the street anymore, which is what he's wanted up until now. And that's kind of sad to watch. And we've always been a pretty physical family, like hugging and kissing and physical touch. So I walked him to school yesterday morning with my youngest, and we get to the top of the stairs, and I said, okay, have a really good day. And I open my arms, and he's just kind of like, just kind of edging away, just edging away from me. And so I just, I tousled his hair and I patted him on the back and I said, I hope you have a really good day. And then his little brother comes up and gets right in his face and just like face to face hugs him. And he's like, I'll miss you. And so he hugs his little brother like, okay. But I found myself yesterday thinking throughout the day, like, great, we don't hug anymore. And he doesn't want that anymore. Yeah. And, you know, we're going to go into that weird desert between fathers and sons where they don't touch and they don't express affection. And then about halfway through the day yesterday, I was like, wait a minute, I'm the one that's in charge of that there. Like, I don't have to, like, I need to respect his boundaries, but I don't have to follow his lead on the tone of the relationship.
And maybe he doesn't want you to hug him as you drop him off at school, but that doesn't mean when he gets home back to the house, he doesn't want a hug.
Yeah, and that's something that we even talked about this morning. I made a point to talk to him about that this morning, and I said, hey, I noticed yesterday it didn't seem like you wanted a hug at school. And he was just, like, he kind of looked down, kind of embarrassed, and said, it's okay. Like, when I was your age, I wouldn't have wanted my dad to hug me in front of my friends. I said, it's okay if I give you a hug before we go. And he gave me a big, big bear hug, and I hugged him back. And I think that recognizing the position that we're in is really important. Sometimes that means that we're in a position where we need to receive a lot.
Yes.
And we need to be open to that. And I think other times it means we're in a position to give and we need to step up and give.
That reminds me of another story for me. You know, when I was, again, maybe like 20, 21, my younger brother, because there were six of us in my family, we were kind of spread out. So my younger brother was, I don't know, maybe like 6 or 7, 8. I'd have to do the math to figure out how many years between us. But he was on a, like, just a recreational soccer team, kind of for the, it was for some of them, it was their first year playing soccer, and they couldn't find a team or a coach for the team. And I had played, I mean, when I was growing up, there wasn't really competition soccer. So I had played rec soccer, but anyway, you know, I certainly could coach first year players, but it's not like I was this amazing coach or something. But my little brother came to me and said, will you be our coach? And so I was like, sure, I'll be your coach. Like, you know, I have time. So I ended up coaching this little boy's soccer team and loved it, absolutely loved it. But one of the things, you know, one of the first games that we played, you know, you're kind of, I mean, again, I'm still 19, 20, something like that. So I'm still somewhat immature. And, you know, like, are we going to win? Like, they seem like they have some potential, but I don't really know how they're going to look up against another team. You know, there were some kids on our team who really did have some potential, and there were some others that, like, were trying to coordinate balance and, like, getting them to kick the soccer ball without falling down and standing on one leg. And so it was kind of this variety. And so the first game, you know, they're out there playing, and, I mean, if you've ever watched kids play soccer some of those first years, it's like they just, it's this massive bodies to just follow this ball.
Bunch ball.
Yes. And the other coach on the other side is like screaming and yelling. And I just remember like watching him and thinking, I am embarrassed for him. Now, I was probably a little more sensitive to this because my parents were both yellers. But I was just like, okay, note to self, I will never do that. Because as I'm watching him yell and scream, either the boys couldn't hear him or they just chose to ignore him. Like, but I was like, they can't even hear you. And you're over here screaming, you're going red in your face, and the kids can't even hear you. And I was just like, I am not going to embarrass myself and look foolish like that. And so I didn't during that soccer season. You know, I just kind of was like, if I'm on the sideline, whether they can hear me or not, I'm only giving praise. I'm just standing, like, during the game, it is my job to stand and say, good job, good job, good job. Again, they're like 6 years old. And then I was like, and then I'm taking notes so that when we go back and have practice during the week, I can work on and give instruction and say, we need to do this better. We didn't do this very well. But I'm not going to be doing that from the sideline at the top of my voice. And so, you know, we had a pretty good season, and I think we won most of our games. And it was a really good moment for me, though, kind of learning some of the child development. And one of the things that I noticed is during the game, when I would yell out, like, that was amazing, oh, it didn't matter how far away they were from me, they heard me.
Mm.
It's not that they couldn't hear me, right? And I would notice that with other coaches who were screaming and like trying to tell them what to do and give them corrective stuff in that tone, they weren't listening.
Yeah.
But like when I said something like, that was so close, that was so awesome, they would turn and they'd like give me the thumbs up or something. Like they could totally hear me. And I think there's something too about just our human nature and timing. And I learned all of that. Thankfully, I'm really thankful I learned that before I ever had kids.
Mm-hmm.
And learning that there's a time in which I give them praise and that's all they need. And then there's another time in which we say, hey, what do we need to do better? What's not working? And knowing that timing plays an important part so that they can hear me when I'm saying that doesn't seem to be working very well. And they can hear me more because at other times all I'm doing is cheering them on.
Yeah, and what that really is to me is that's building a relationship rather than a behavior management plan.
Right.
Or
a winning team.
Yeah, and when it comes to parents and kids, I think there's definitely that stark contrast. But I think also in our adult relationships, like, we can get into that behavior management mode.
Mm-hmm.
We can manipulate, we can coerce, we can threaten, we can be passive aggressive. Mm-hmm. All of that. And I think that there definitely needs to be room in our connected relationships for that hard feedback or for that, mm-hmm. hey, can we take a look at this?
Right.
But like you said, that doesn't go anywhere if there's not a relationship first.
Yeah.
And when the two people in the relationship can't answer the question in the affirmative, is the overall feel of our relationship that we're on the same team?
Right.
I think when that is the feel, like, there's a lot of places we can go with other people. There's a lot of places we can let ourselves be taken,
uh-huh.
with other people. But without that,
yeah,
you know, we tend to tune
well,
it out.
And it reminds me of, I don't know the quote exactly verbatim or something, but it's a Thomas Merton quote, and it's on love. And he talks about, you know, he kind of asks the question and says, is it really love if the person is always doing what we would want them to do?
Hmm.
Right? Can we even call that love? Or is that just really self-love?
Hmm.
Right? Like the image that I see in you is my image because you're doing everything I think you should be doing. And so do I really love that person, or do I love my reflection in that person?
Hmm.
Right? Is that narcissistic self-love? And he, you know, and he asks the question, can we really love another person? Or the question, like, maybe love starts the moment that person does something we would never do.
Yeah.
Good or bad, but they do something that we wouldn't do. And we accept them anyway.
Mm-hmm.
We witness that and we stick with them and we don't try to talk him out of doing that or something. Like, but they truly become somebody different than us.
Yeah.
And we still accept them and stay in the relationship. Now we might be talking about love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really like that thought. I think of Rob Bell and some of what he talks about around love and relationships and that reciprocity, and
mm-hmm.
you know, I really think that we need that separateness, and we need that differentiation, and we need that heartache in order for love.
Have you listened to his series with Pete Rollins on love?
I started it.
Oh my gosh.
And so, for, like you've said before, Pete Rollins is awesome to listen to because of his Irish accent.
Yeah.
I also thought it was great that you could hear Pete Rollins talk, and I don't know if Pete Rollins caught this, but he would say words and Rob would be like one of them was cow. He said cow, but he said it like Kai. And Rob was like, Kai, like in the background.
I get it.
Yeah. But I thought there were some really interesting ideas there.
So you've listened to the first part of that series.
I listened to the first one where he was talking about the role that the church played in preserving lust. Prohibit and say, we don't do this. He said that's actually what keeps that.
Yes.
That's one of the things that keeps that passion
powerful,
alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we'll have to talk some more as you listen to 2 and 3, because it was good stuff.
Yeah. I think that's probably a good place to pause for today. Thank you for joining us for story time. We want to remind you that your story matters too, and remember that there's something meaningful in every chapter. Don't wait to share your story until it's finished.
You can share your story with us on our Facebook page, Healing Paths, Inc., or on our website, www.thanksforsharingpodcast.com. This podcast is solely for the purpose of information and entertainment and does not constitute therapy, nor should it replace competent professional help.
At the end of another episode, we want to remind you that nobody has time for perfection. We are pursuing progress.
And remember the prayer of the perfectionist. Help me remember I can't do it all. Help me to take things one step at a time, and that the only step I need to focus on is the next right step for me.
Help me to remember that life is a journey. Help me to be able to separate all that I am learning from all that I have to do. Help me to remember that I am not alone, that I can ask for help. Help me to strive for frequent awakenings, not mastery. I am enough. Amen.